Accession number 31693, Reel 21.
Mr. Robson, Reel 21. You've just moved to B Company. Can you take me through the composition of the company from the commanding officer down through the various units.
It was obviously I can't remember the platoon commanders, but certainly the company commander was Major Crawford, and the sergeant major was Bob Penman, and the signals corporal was a guy called Pete Higgins, and when I arrived there, there were short staffed. And I don't honestly know why. We had four platoons, one of which I believe was the Bugle platoon, but I'm not 100% certain. And the B Company platoon itself, if you sit, have a look, if you think of Plum and Mapau had actually, when it was under the auspices of the Parachute Regiment, had an attack by the Indonesians before we took over from them. But then it was only, if I remember rightly, a platoon base. And then it was, because of the attack, it became a company base. Although we didn't take over from the Parachute Regiment, we took over from the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, I believe, and it just extended our area of operations. We all lived, believe it or not, in dugouts, very similar to what was like in the First World War. The particular dugout we were in, there was four of us. There was Pete Higgins, who was the platoon, who was the company signalist corporal, and then there was myself and two others. And although we slept in a type of bunk beds, they weren't normal bunk beds. They were homemade ones, and it was. We were right underneath the 105 millimetre howitzer position, so whenever the 105 howitzer had to fire a mission, we had to get out of there. It didn't matter what time of day it was. If we'd been on duty all night, we had to get out for safety reasons, in case the thing collapsed on top of us. You could up to about I think if they did a charge threes and fours or fives, I think it was, we were all right. But anything over that, because the distance involved, then we had to get out. And it was, I mean, there was no privacy. You just had a curtain across the entrance to it, and because of the. We weren't allowed any food in there because of rats, because there was plenty of rats around, and they would often wake you up scurrying about. And in there we'd have our ammunition, our whatever equipment we required, your rifle, because the rifle always had to be within close reach of you, because we could be attacked at any time again by the Indonesians. Although we had a good understanding with the local kampong that we had near us, they used to come up and do work and washing for us. But on the whole, we did our own washing anyway. I can't remember the colour sand, but while we were in there, we were only allowed, for a couple of reasons, we were only allowed either two soft drinks or two beers per night. And the reason for the B, of course, is we're on operations, so you never got you never grow any more than that. And the reason for the soft drinks as well, we only issued to, was the supply. Because we were deep in the jungle, our only supply was by aircraft, by the RAF or the Australian Air Force.
And were those drops or helicopters?
No, these were actually parachute drops. And of course, they never ever got all their parachutes back, because it came in handy. Ideal for when we went out on patrol, we made our own sleeping bags, because it was so light, and we could actually fit them in a little pouch, and so we kept all of those if we could. And but yeah, we had this drop every 4 or 5 days. Of course, if the weather came in, started getting a little bit tight then for meals and what have you. But for the first couple of days, two, three days, we would get fresh rations. Then after that, we'd have to eat the standby rations, which weren't so good. But overall, food-wise, I mean, it was normal. I mean, you would have your breakfast with bacon and egg and stuff like this, and cereal. And if you wanted a cup of tea, there was always cups of tea on the go. But again, when you move around, you always moved around with your weapon at all times. Even when you went to have a shower, you would have a magazine. You'd have your fighting pack, which is your pouches with your magazines and your rifle. Even when you went for a shower. So yes, it wasn't comfortable, put it this way.
So you had your own cooks with you?
Yes, we had our own. The army catering cooks. I think we had a corporal in charge of the kitchen. And what they did, the meals that they did in those circumstances were excellent. And you didn't get your meal and go to your little dugout. We had a proper kitchen and a proper eating area where you used to meet up, which was also where the canteen on a night time. When you moved around, I mean, you still observed a bit of a blackout. You always had a torch with you, because you had to be careful that you didn't fall into a trench.
I was going to say, were the dugouts linked by trenches as well?
They were all linked by trenches. Because you've got to remember, at that time, the Indonesian army, they had a 175mm howitzer, which was a Russian gun. And although it was well back in Indonesia, they reckon that it still could reach us. That they had the advantage where they did have the distance over us. All we had was the 105mm howitzer, which didn't have a greater range than what the Indonesians had.
So, what kind of, or could you estimate the size of the camp in total?
No, I can't.
It must have been reasonable size.
It was a fair size, because we had four platoons in there, and you were talking somewhere in the region of 150 men in that position. And yes, we were all dug in. We were all had our, so really we were just like ants in the hillside, because everybody was exactly the same. We all were in a dugout, which was similar to what it was like in the First World War.
And were the platoons allocated in an area of the perimeter?
Yeah, each platoon was allocated. Obviously, at that time, there was always one platoon out on operations, on patrols. So right around the perimeter, there were permanent GPMG Porsche. There was a motor section. There was, as I say, there was a 105 millimeter howitzer, which, if I remember rightly, we were from the 29 Royal Artillery, which was a commando unit, and they were with us for the whole of the time we were in Plum and Mappau. There was one way in and one way out into the position, and obviously it was always guarded by someone, and we had GPMG positions all the way around in fixed positions, heavy machine guns, and also roundabout we also had Claymore mines, which could be set off for defence in case we were attacked. We also had geophones, and that was actually little microphones all around the perimeter, and again we could listen in to anybody. We switched on a night, and it would pick up small noises right throughout. That was the problem with it. It was so good, it was too good, it would pick up everything, all animals and everything which were going round. And that was the job of the signals. Whoever was on duty on a night time, his duty would be to listen also to the geophones round the perimeter of the camp. The local people, they used to come in. However, one young kid, I remember, he was caught with a plan of the camp or the position. He was questioned by our intelligence people, and it was left to the local villagers to deal with, and they dealt with him appropriately. He wasn't allowed. They kept him under not lock and key, but they kept a close eye, and he wasn't allowed to go away from the kampong, because along that border, a lot of people don't realise, but a lot of the people were interrelated. Both sides of the border, they were, because of the tribes that were there, they didn't care about a border. To them, it was just an island, and they didn't know whether it was Malaysia or Indonesia. To them, it was Borneo, and consequently, they were always crossing the frontier or the border. They would be stopped and be checked, but it was a good thing in a way as well, because they also used to give us information, because they'd been to visit relatives on the other side of the border. I mean, it wasn't marked, isn't it? There was no stakes or no white post to say it was crossing the border. It was on the top of a big hill, and that was how we knew when we used to cross the border.
So your relationships with the locals was a pretty good one, and I think this was quite deliberate, wasn't it, on
your... Oh, yes. Whenever we were out, not just the local kampongs, but whenever we were out, we always used to make sure that we visited the local kampongs, and it was called Hearts and Minds, dealing with any problems that they had, any injuries or any illnesses. When a patrol went out, we had somebody who was trained in on the medical side, so that we could give them help whenever they required it, as I say, illnesses and what have you. But they had their own ways of dealing with illnesses anyway, which were passed down by, you know, hundreds of years. And really, the people that survived in the jungle, I have a lot of admiration for. They were absolutely wonderful people. Very simple, very friendly, always willing to help out.
Did you get involved in any river patrols? I think there was water patrols of some kind.
It was. I don't know which. I think that was Air Company got involved in river patrols. B Company never. We were always on our always on our feet. I can't remember exactly where we were in the position where we were, but it wasn't that far. When I say it wasn't that far, it would maybe take us a day to get up onto the border. The only time I was ever over that side, although because as a regimental signaller, the only time we went out was with the company commander if there was a big operation. And the time I was with B Company, we did have one such operation. And this was just after President Sukarno was overthrown by President Suharto. And there wasn't a lot of happenings on the border. And B Company were tasked with going and finding out what was happening on the other roundabout, and we actually went out in full company except for a platoon which was left back in the base, and we went out in it must have been some sight for a whole company to go out, and I was with Major Crawford when we went out on this patrol to find out what was happening in Indonesia, on the border area of Indonesia. And as soon as we reached the border, this is when tensions heightened, because we never knew if we were going to get ambushed or not. And we actually went over the border, and Major Crawford pointed and said to me, "We are now in Indonesia." And once into Indonesia, you would keep in communication contact back with B Company and also with the battalion headquarters in case we needed help straight away, i.e. mortars, because mortars had moved up. I believe they'd moved the 105 up as well, to give us cover and fire just in case that we needed it when we went into Indonesia. And I always remember coming down a hill on the other side and coming to a stream. When I say a stream, it was a fairly wide stream and flat ground, and Major Crawford saying to me, "This is ideal ambush territory." And when I looked around and I could see what he meant, we were crossing the stream. I mean, when I say we were crossing the stream, we were in the centre of the patrol, because there was other platoons out. And from there, they would go out. And we found out that where we'd had contacts previously, they'd moved the base back and they'd closed it down. So on that case, it was quite successful, and we were out about, if I remember rightly, about 4 or 5 days, and it was a successful patrol. We had no contact. There was the trackers that we had were E-bands, and they had said there'd been no movement in that area for quite some time. From what I gather later, after we came back from the patrol, there had been quite violent riots in Jakarta, and everything from then on was all quiet. And we still went out, and we still sent platoons out to make sure that nothing was happening. But that was my last big patrol in Indonesia, and I must admit, I enjoyed my time with the, up in the front, because it was a more relaxed atmosphere. It wasn't regimental. There was no saluting of officers, although we still had, you know, there was no standing to attention or anything like that. Because when you're up in the front, you do not want to give away the rank of a person, because you never ever know. So it was a much, much more relaxed atmosphere than back in battalion headquarters. So I enjoyed it up there.
How accurate were the airdrops that you posted, Griff? I mean, it isn't what shall we say, an exact science, is it?
No, it isn't. It was when we did get the airdrop. There was a particular a spot that they tried to hit, but yet but you're right, it wasn't a science. It was a lot of the stuff, I must admit, did land in the zone, but a lot of it missed. And I can't remember how many steps there were from where we had, I think it was around about 190, right to the bottom, where we had to go down and pick up the stuff which was actually missed the drop. And especially on if you get a maldrop, especially a malfunction of the parachute, and especially if it was our naffy rations, i.e. the beer and the stuff. But it used to be quite funny, because all the NCOs used to line the route from the drop zone all the way up to the company stores, in case anybody got all of a crate and secreted away, and it did happen. But the colour sergeant and the sergeant major knew exactly what stuff was being dropped, and if there's any stuff missing, they got back very, very quickly, because there would no, the threat was, if you didn't return it, then there'd be no issue of beer or cigarettes or anything. It's a bit of blackmail, but it worked. So yes, it was the only time you had to be careful, is if you needed any of the steel posts, which were used for the perimeter fence and for keeping the barbed wire and everything in. And it was when they came down, they came on a free drop. And they were dangerous. You just hope that you weren't under one of those when it was a free drop. Other stuff which would drop came in on the parachutes. But even, I mean, the parachutes were absolutely brilliant, because in our little dugouts, we used to have the parachutes over the top of the dugouts. Not to keep it warm, because it was warm enough, but it's better than having, looking at dirt and everything, just to brighten it up a bit. But it was quite good.
Did you ever have to use mules, or were they used by the battalion?
Not in B Company. We didn't have a mules. The only mules that we had was the men on their 2 feet. But no, we didn't have any mules. Not that I can. They may have been in other companies, but certainly not in, not that I remember, in B Company. We didn't. No, it doesn't come to mind. I don't think we had mules in B Company.
So at some period, of course, you would need to relax, and you have mentioned rest and recuperation. Where did it happen, and what kind of rest were you getting?
They used to take it, I can't remember if it was a platoon at the time or not, but they were taken back to Ballaringen, which is the battalion headquarters, and from there they had 4 days in Kuching.
What was it like?
I didn't go. I just didn't want it. In all the time I was there, I worked all the time, and I just didn't want to go back to Kuching for rest and recuperation. I felt all right. I didn't feel that I wanted it. Some people did. Not all people did.
And probably not in Beacon, but there were one or two casualties during the time you were there, weren't there?
B Company, I think now it's and Tommy. Whether Tommy was with B Company, there was some casualties, and it was Tommy got killed then.
And that was his surname, Tommy?
Names. Tommy Griffiths, there was him and five were wounded, and Tony Bartlett, he was one of the corporals, he got wounded at the same time. Another lad called Pete Flynn, who I knew, who was in training with me. A platoon commander was Kirk, I think it was, he got wounded, and a couple of others. And they were with A Company, and they were brought out of the jungle sometime. The platoon was taken out. They were taken out of operation, frontline operations, for a while, till they got sorted out. And at the time when I was at battalion headquarters, I actually went out with them on a patrol. On a couple of patrols, in actual fact, it was just really to get their confidence back, because they'd been hit hard by a young lad, Tommy Griffiths, who'd been killed. And although I wasn't a close friend of Tommy, I knew him, and I knew his brother, and because his brother was on the same patrol when he was killed. Which was rather tragic, really. And it was actually a mortar round which landed behind him, which killed him.